Call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. It's February 11th. We're in Juneau, Alaska at the Senate Finance Committee. Present today, it's a couple of minutes after 9 o'clock. Chairman Stedman, Chairman Olson is excused. We have Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk. We have a forum to conduct business. Today we are going to be hearing from the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Please come forward, Jason Bruhn, the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation chairman, board chairman, and the director of the corporation, Devin Mitchell. Please identify yourselves and proceed with your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Bruni, and I'm the chair of the Alaska Permanent Fund Board of Trustees.
For the record, Devin Mitchell, Executive Director and CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation.
We are very excited to be here today. Thanks again so much for this opportunity, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am fortunate to be the chair. The members of the Board of Trustees, there are six of us. We have our vice chair, Commissioner Adam Crum, in the room with us today. There are two required trustees that are on the cabinet. One of them is the Commissioner of Revenue, that's Commissioner Crum, and the other is Commissioner Anderson from Fairbanks. We have former AG Craig Richards, who is one of our trustees, Ethan Schutt, who is former chair as well, and then just last week, John Binkley from Fairbanks was named as the sixth trustee. So that's who your trustees are. We do not make investment decisions like specific managers. We make the ranges, and then Devin and their team set the specific investments and the policies, choose the managers, you name it. So, but it is an honor to serve, and I want to turn it over to Devin to give the majority of the presentation, but we are going to be talking about some things that I've had the privilege to talk to Senate President Stevens and Majority Leader Kathy Geisel about potential legislative and constitutional changes that I know we're going to want to talk about. And again, we're excited to be here, and I'll turn it over to Devin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to recognize Senator Geisel. She's here in the audience as well. Mr. Devin.
Mr. Chairman, Mitchell. Devin Mitchell again. So in the course of our presentation today, as Chair Bruni pointed out, I'll give some comments. We have a couple of our senior investment team here, our Chief Investment Officer, Marcus Frampton, and Megan are having a child today, which I'm hopeful maybe George is here now and am looking forward to seeing a new addition to our work family. So that's good news. And I guess I do believe that Marcus is uniquely gifted at describing markets and the permanent fund and our application of the investment strategies. But we have Deputy CIO Jim Parise, who's our public markets. He oversees fixed income and public equity. And then Alan Waldron, our deputy CIO that oversees private markets, so private equity, private income, and real estate. Absolute returns kind of in no man's land, and Marcus still primarily oversees absolute return as well as the asset class, the 1% tactical that he deploys. So just to start off with our standard presentation, the permanent fund, of course, was created in 1976. The fund was created out of a fairly perfect storm of revenue received by the state of Alaska, large revenue received after the lease sale in Prudhoe. The residents of the state seeing that utilized, the pipeline being near completion and a recognition there's going to be additional revenue coming to the state and the desire to control the growth of government and controls the spending that the state had seen in recent times and anticipated. And then in the future after the TAPS was done, and then the high oil price that we saw after TAPS was done that allowed people to actually kind of step back from considering spending the money that was going into the permanent fund. Obviously, it was created not with a specific purpose. It was just created as a savings mechanism. So 25% of the royalty revenue from the slope is the primary revenue that goes into the fund. Some other revenues from other resource development also goes into the fund. But the vast majority comes from North Slope oil production. And at this point, we have the largest U.S. sovereign wealth fund, which is an incredible thing for a state with a population our size. Obviously, a lot of geographical landmass, but a small population. These are the frameworks that we have that we live by at the permanent fund. The mission is to act as the state's investment house. So we have a professional investment staff and an institutional investment bent that we pursue. The asset classes that we have are comparable to any world-class institutional investor. If you were to look, we will during the course of the presentation look at some of our contemporaries. You'd see that we have a level of sophistication that isn't found at every fund, and we both benefit from and suffer from that structure. And meaning that every market is different, but over the long term, we anticipate that our structure is going to outperform and that we're going to add value. And just as a quick plug, if you look back over the last 10 years, the management of the investments by the Permanent Fund Corporation has added something around $5 billion in value by beating the benchmark, our performance benchmark, during that time frame. So total nominal dollars that have been generated in that same 10-year time frame, $55 billion. And so $55 billion of gains generated by the activity of the corporation. And if you compared that performance to a passive benchmark, something that we suffer in relation to in the short term, last year and the year before, the passive benchmark has outperformed our performance benchmark. But over that 10-year time frame, it's something closer to $14 billion that was added value as a result of the performance of the permanent funds investing. The vision, obviously, is not just for today, but for today and tomorrow. And that is something that we take very seriously, that we're looking for, again, the long-term performance, not a short-term performance. The Board of Trustees, Jason already described, and the constitutional and statutory allowances are described on the right-hand side of this page, along with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Fund and Power Cost Equalization Endowment, which are co-managed or co-invested, I should say, by the Permanent Fund Corporation for the benefit of those entities.
For the record, Jason Bruni. I want to take this opportunity to thank members of the Senate Finance Committee and the legislature for the partnership that we've had. Obviously, over 50% of our budget, our general fund budget, is now funded with permanent fund earnings. And so I know that the emphasis of the Board of Trustees has been to make sure we're taking care of our staff and recruiting and retaining the best folks we can that have a statutory responsibility to maximize returns for the state of Alaska. And so that has been a keen focus for the 2.5 years that I've been on the board, is making sure that we're taking care of them. So thank you to the legislature for fully funding our incentive compensation that we put forward a couple of years ago. Obviously, we've been putting a key focus on making sure we have the best and brightest. Obviously, I know there's some controversy about some of the actions that we've taken, but you know, I'll point out that we try to have the best folks that we can. And if that means in an Anchorage office or in the lower 48 or here in Juneau, We want the best folks that are working to maximize returns for our state. So that has been a keen emphasis. The headquarters of the permanent fund is in Juneau and will always be in Juneau. And we're, again, very appreciative of the partnership we have with the legislature. We also, you know, want to thank the legislature for the funding that we get for our IT systems. We need to make sure that we're protecting the assets that we have. We do have some specific legislative requests that we are going to be informing you of. They haven't been put forward by the administration, but it is something that any, obviously, legislator can consider introducing. One of them is and this is on slide five, right now, public records are an issue when we want to evaluate our executive director in light
before
of some...
Before you go to slide five, I would like to say that the percentage of market value was started here in 2019. It was a piece of legislation that this committee introduced and worked on. And prior to that, the fund, the earnings of the permanent fund were set aside for a rainy day fund, and it took a lot of time and energy and courage by the legislature to pass Senate Bill 26 that now is the basis of the primary funding source for the services of the people of the state of Alaska. And I just wanted to state that for the record and let the public know that that is the source of revenue that was initiated, that concept was initiated at this committee. Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just before we got off slide four, I wanted to note the bullet there on the bottom right about accountability. I'm pleased to see that rhetoric. That's new. The legislature's been treated in the past to screeds from past chairs, not the current chair, of the board about the audacity of the legislature daring oversight. I'm interested in further accountability.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Keel, and thank you, Chair Hoffman. Yes, it was wise leadership from Senate Finance that did pass POMV. I know that's something that the business community had been asking for years. The business community and the trustees have also been asking for the merging of the accounts, and we're going to be talking about that later. And yes, for sure, Senator Keel, through the chair, we are absolutely accountable to the legislature, and we value your input and want to work collaboratively. One thing I did neglect to say on the previous slide was that part of the amazing work that the staff has done is we've brought a lot of the investment work in-house. We used to pay people to do it. Now we are having Alaskans do this work for us, and they're doing a great job on it. So we're excited to be building our team that way. So back to slide five. Because of some historical issues, there is now some concern about putting evaluations of our executive director or indeed any of our staff on the record because of the ability for those to be requested by the media and released. I struggle with that as someone who managed large teams. So there's worries about giving honest and true feedback in writing to our executive director or our senior leadership because of that discoverability. In addition, one of the things we're concerned about is if we want good candidates to apply for high-level positions, ultimately the media can request those. And so if we have great candidates that are in really good jobs, if they end up making it to the finals, their name would be discoverable, and that may not go over well with our current employer. So that on slide five, that discusses potential changes that the legislature could make that would bring a level of confidentiality for personnel records to our staff. It's something I think is very important, especially as we're trying to recruit and retain the best and brightest to come and work for the permanent fund. So that's happy to have additional discussions. That is not a bill that the administration has put forward. I don't work for the administration anymore, so I can say I'm fully supportive and would be happy to work with any of you in putting something like this together, because I think the permanent fund needs it.
Devin Mitchell again. So the findings of the permanent fund are described on page 7 of the presentation today. The idea behind creation of the fund are fairly basic. The creation of a permanent savings account, so an account that's for, in my view, similar to fish and game in Alaska, that we have a maximum sustainable yield practice, but we don't over-harvest because we just get a share that's fair for us today, and we leave the amount that's required for the people of tomorrow to have a fair share as well. And that same principle applies to the permanent fund, that we get our fair share, but the only reason this fund exists is because of the sacrifice of the residents of this state of the past, that if they wouldn't have set money aside that they could have spent, oftentimes when it was badly needed for the various needs of the state, and instead they saved it so that we would benefit from the value that exists within the permanent fund. I had a conversation with Senator Kaufman yesterday about if there hadn't been action to inflation-proof and otherwise grow the permanent fund through additional deposits to principal, the balance you might see in the fund would be $20 billion. Those are the actual deposits. And actually, it might not even be $20 billion, because I believe that includes both the royalty revenue that's required under the Constitution in addition to the 25% of royalty revenue that the legislature has appropriated into the permanent fund over the years. And so you would have a pretty significantly different account if the residents of the past hadn't done what we would suggest we should again do in each and every generation from here forward.
The magic of the permanent fund is that it turned a non-renewable resource into a renewable resource, and that is something that Alaskans can be proud of.
Absolutely.
Yes. This describes those deposits into the fund. You can see the fiscal year-to-date principal savings in the bar chart, that $20 billion of mineral royalties that have been deposited into the fund, the $27.6 billion of inflation-proofing, $11 billion of special appropriations. Approximately $2.3 billion of those were from the general fund, the rest from excess earnings in the earnings reserve account. And then the unrealized gains. The unrealized gains, of course, are not really part of the principal balance of the permanent fund. They're just allocated to principal. To the extent those gains are realized, they'll shift over to the spendable category in the earnings reserve account. $91 billion in realized earnings generated by the fund's investment over the life of the fund. It's pretty incredible, and you layer on top an additional $15 billion of unrealized gains. You're at $106 billion of earnings or gains that the permanent fund has generated for the residents of the state of Alaska. The use of that money, the realized earnings, you can see paid out to current generations through the POMV distributions since fiscal year 2019, $22.6 billion. The dividend appropriations prior to that through fiscal year 2018 of $24.4 billion. And the Alaska Capital Income Fund, which is a long explanation about the Amerita Hess settlement and a subaccount within the permanent fund due to a court case. So there's a little bit of money that's accounted for differently in the Amerita Hess settlement due to the Amerita Hess settlement. There's one note on here. The fiscal year 25 inflation proofing $1 billion, that was an appropriation for the current fiscal year's inflation proofing. At this point in time, the statutory formula would generate a $1.7 billion number for the year, so we're a little bit under what the statute would indicate should be transferred from the earnings reserve account into principal. But that's one of the concepts that we talk about throughout our discussions in Trustee Paper 10 is that when the earnings reserve account is experiencing lesser balances, that's one of the levers that's available for the legislature to pull to ensure that there's sufficient liquidity for the annual percent of market value transfer that the chair pointed out is the largest single source of revenue to the state of Alaska from an unrestricted general fund perspective at this point. And so that's reasonable to do, but it should be done with the expectation that there will be makeup for that in future years when there isn't that stress on the earnings reserve account. And we've seen that in practice. There's some checks over here that indicate that the legislature's done that in the past, and we would advocate for it in the future and keep track of it.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you put it in more simpler terms so I can follow what we're talking about here? If we go back in history from the beginning and we take the $1 billion that's in this year's budget, the extra appropriations in total, or how are we doing inflation proofing, either positive or negative? So we have a general idea, the committee, when we have these discussions, how far ahead we are on inflation proofing or behind in any given year.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman. We do have a slide on that, but in general terms, over the course of the last 10 years, there's been more variability to the appropriations for inflation proofing. That started when the price of oil dropped in 2014 calendar year, affecting 2015 fiscal year's revenue for the state of Alaska in a significant way. The state was experiencing $3 billion-ish deficits, and the legislature determined that it was unwise to segregate money within the earnings reserve account to principal while experiencing the uncertainty of that time frame. That was the first time that there was a break from the historical practice of inflation proofing based on the statutory guidance that's provided. The makeup of $4 billion that I referenced based on the check over here from July 1st, 2019 paid the current year's inflation proofing as well as provided for the inflation proofing that had been foregone, as well as provided an expectation of paying inflation proofing forward. The second $4 billion check that sits over there from July of 21 was not identified as inflation proofing, so that becomes part of this conversation on a fundamental basis. Was it inflation proofing or not? The simple language of the appropriation didn't identify it as inflation proofing, so we don't count it as such. But if you did, it changes that calculation fairly drastically. So if you don't include it, we're about $2 billion behind on inflation proofing appropriations. And if you do count it, you're $2 billion ahead. So we don't count it based on the language. The body could decide that that was something that they could revisit, I suppose.
Senator Stedman.
Well, I sat here and advocated for that $4 billion, and I can assure you it was to compensate for inflation proofing, even though it wasn't in the language of the bill. It wasn't a charity gift. It wasn't a side thought. And it needs to be counted for inflation proofing, and we need to monitor the thief in the night, which is inflation, over a period of years since inception to be on point if we start getting behind. My concern is going forward that, you know, we may be in a position where we get several billion behind, and I really don't want to see that. But when we had the discussions in this current year's budget where we did $1 billion, we were looking at the total inflation proofing over the life of the fund. That's the important number that we keep up with.
Thank you, Senator Stedman.
Just one quick point.
Yes, Senator
Stedman. The second check, the reason it was on the second check, the reason it was specifically noted as inflation proofing was for the very reason that the board ignored that issue on the first check. And the politics on the first check was a little bit different. But clearly that's what the intent was, that we don't have the thief in the night slowly erode the permanent fund for future generations.
as a chairman of the operating budget at the time, I would suggest that the board take note of that.
Thank you.
And I was referring to Senator Stedman. Mr. Mitchell or Mr. Bruni, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that there's strong concurrence with the sentiments expressed by Senator Stedman throughout our organization as well as the state of Alaska, so I appreciate the comment. I think this dovetails back to the comment you made, Mr. Chair, earlier in the presentation about the shifting of a non-renewable resource to a renewable resource, that the state of Alaska has a relatively narrow economy and relatively small in comparison to the United States, something around 50 to 7 billion of GDP. And we have the ability, we've had the ability to use the permanent fund to rely not on our economy for revenue generation through a broad-based tax, but to rely on the world's economy through the investment of the proceeds of the permanent fund to provide revenues for the state of Alaska's use. So we're investing the permanent fund around the world, primarily in the United States, but around the world for the benefit of the residents of the state of Alaska. And the actual investments, I referred to this a little bit earlier, that the sophistication of the permanent fund's asset allocation has grown over the years. 1980, primarily fixed income exposure in the portfolio, some public equity and real estate introduced in the 80s through 1990 and 2006, absolute return and private equity have been added, private income since then, and tactical ops more recently. And so we have 8 asset classes designed to interact with one another in a way that minimizes risk while maximizing the expectation of hitting our target rates of return for the fund. Slide 10 demonstrates that the target return objectives of the fund are difficult to achieve. The gold dot is the, so we have a, there's 3 benchmarks that we compare ourselves to. We have a performance benchmark, which is probably most appropriate for purposes of determining the success of the investment activity of the corporation. We have a passive benchmark, just to give you an idea of how the money would perform if you had a fairly simplistic and less active investment strategy. And then we have the return objective of CPI plus 5, because that's the actual anticipated use of the permanent fund given the percent of market value construct that we operate within. The gold dot on the bar graph is the target of CPI plus 5, so inflation plus 5%, so that you maintain the purchasing power of the fund at the same time you make the outflow to the state of Alaska. And you can see there's, in this chart of 10-year historical lookbacks, a 10-year period where the permanent fund didn't achieve that target of CPI plus 5. It did prior to and subsequent to that time frame, but it highlights the cyclicality of markets. It highlights the difficulty of achieving a CPI plus 5 target rate of return. I think the year to, during my time frame, that when I first began working at the fund, the immediately past year, 2022, the inflation rate was 7%, and the fund earned negative 1.2%. Outperformed its benchmark, but lost 1.2%. Outperformed the passive benchmark significantly, double-digit percentage. But you go, okay, well, 7% plus 5%, we're 12% behind, plus 1.2% loss, we're 13% behind in 1 year. And that's really not that significant of a market event in comparison to the dot-coms eras or the global financial crisis of 2008 or the some of the other market experiences over the history of the United States markets.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, I think there was some concern by some of us that the 5% is too high, and it takes all of the potential growth out of the permanent fund. And when we look at the performance of the Alaska Mental Health Trust portfolio, they're at 4.25 down in that range. And they have some growth and a potential left on the table. And I think we need to have that discussion in coming months when we look at restructuring, or years, however long it takes us to actually get to the constitutional amendment to roll the earnings reserve into the permanent fund or into the corpus. And I recognize that by taking the payout from 5 to any number lower than that is less revenue for the state and dividends. That doesn't go unnoticed. But what also shouldn't go unnoticed is our ability to not grow the permanent fund. And it's grown substantially over the decades. And if we can get that fund to continue to grow, it will greatly benefit future generations of Alaskans. And we may have to suck it up for a couple of years, Mr. Chairman, when we do that, if we do, in fact, draw less than 5%. But I haven't seen any presentations that talk about drawing over 5% is good for the state. And there was even concern when we did Senate Bill 26, Mr. Chairman, that 5% was set because it was the maximum draw rate. And now we've got several years of history on it. So I think it's just a point, Mr. Chairman, that we need to have dialogue in the future and decide collectively in the legislature and the public, you know, do we want to maximize today's revenue stream and give no growth to the future citizens of Alaska, or do we want to let them have a little bit of the benefit going forward like our forefathers did to us?
It should be noted that in Senate Bill 26, the first 2 years, the draw was 5.25%.
Mr. Chair, I neglected to introduce a couple of my staff that are here this year. We brought a little more robust bench than we have in past years. And so Val Mertz is our chief financial officer, and Sebastian Vadakamcheri is our chief risk and compliance officer, and Paul N. Swanson's our communications director. And the reason I'm bringing them up now is Senator Stedman's comments about whether 5% is too high or low. From time to time, Sebastian, our chief risk and compliance officer, does one-off analysis, and he's recently been examining the mathematical question about whether or not 5% is over the long term achievable given historical performance of markets, and the initial read was that it was aggressive, 5% was aggressive, and there was some concern. There was if I'm remembering correctly, there was a 30% probability with a 5% draw that you would have a failure of some point. That flip-flops and you have a 70% chance of not having a failure if you reduce that draw to something around 4.3 ish, and I'm probably misstating these numbers, but and that analysis wasn't complete. We had a conversation the other day in his office on a one-off basis, but it was interesting that you can break it down to a mathematical question, and it isn't always, because we don't know what the future holds. We don't know. I mean, we have capital market assumptions from Callan that are right or wrong, left or right, but we do have an expectation that we can look back and see what's happened, and that gives us some realistic probability that it will happen again. And with that in mind, there was cause for consideration about what the draw an appropriate draw rate is. From just this chart, I think it shows that 5% is a high target, and it probably is about what it can be.
Mr. Chair, to be very clear, the Board of Trustees believes it's this body's job to determine what the draw should be. We obviously want to maximize the returns so that there is money there for you to choose how to or the amount to appropriate, but we will absolutely look at any scenarios, 4.5, 5, 5.25, whatever the amount is, but we're not going to take a position on what the amount should be that is drawn by this body.
Senator Stedman.
Well, we can compare it to the Alaska Mental Health Trust portfolio and take a look at how how their performance is relative to the permanent fund and gauge it politically what we want to set that rate at, and we can have that conversations in the future. But your comment leads me to another major concern that hopefully we'll be addressing through this presentation, and I perceive a delinking between your customer or your client, which is us, and the statute of maximizing rate of return, pushing the concern being pushing the allocation, asset allocation, into illiquid investments that don't return cash flow to the state for years. And as that percentage has increased in the permanent fund, the earnings reserve then comes under pressure and liquidity. And I recognize that there's greater probability of a higher rate of return in some of these illiquid investments. But it's like if you're dealing with a retired person in the private sector and they come in and they want to know where their check is for the year so they can pay their utilities and buy groceries, and you tell them, well, we don't have any cash because we put it all in illiquid investments and you're going to make more money in the long term. You need to go to the Salvation Army for lunch. That doesn't cut it. So you need to, in my opinion, give the some more weighting in the discussion of the 5% draw and help us, not that amount is right, but the draw portion, and give the legislature and the people some more consideration as we work forward and try to get to the endowment position. Because if you run too high of an allocation into the liquid investments, you're going to be having to liquidate some illiquid investments, and the whole process of trying to get to an endowment is going to collapse on our heads because the people aren't going to put up with it. Other than that, everything's okay. But those are the main concern here today when we go through this presentation, and I've expressed it in earlier meetings, but it is a concern.
Yep. Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I absolutely hear you loudly and clearly. Our statutory charge is to maximize the return for the people of Alaska. And we actually have had this discussion a number of times about what is the charge when the legislature is drawing 5%. So trust me, those conversations are had. We recognize the partnership we have with the legislature, and we need to be listening, and we need to make sure that we provide the liquidity so that when the legislature chooses to draw whatever amount, that it's available. But we also, again, our statutory charge is to maximize the return. So it's a difficult position that we're in, but I absolutely hear you, and I understand that perspective. And so if there needs to be specific statutory direction for us to ensure a certain amount of liquidity, I mean, we have a responsibility to follow the law. But we also have a responsibility to listen to this body to make sure that we're providing that. And I know Devin has we've had a lot of discussions about this exact point, Senator Stedman.
Thank you. Mr. Mitchell. Please proceed.
Yep. So this is the point in the presentation where we're going to invite Jim and Alan up to the table to discuss some of the specifics about the investment strategies.
Time management, we're on page 12. We've been here for 40 minutes, and
yes,
we have an hour and 20 minutes to go.
I can speak quickly. For the record, my name is Jim Parise. I'm the Director of Fixed Income and also the Deputy CIO for Public Markets. So my day job is managing the fixed income portfolio. I'm going to expand a little bit on what Devin said as far as the benchmarks And the perspective I'm going to give is through the investors' eyes that work for the permanent fund, and how we work with benchmarks and how we manage against benchmarks, which is what we're charged to do. So on page 12, if you look at the right side, that is essentially where Callan, who is our consultant, comes up with the market expectation over the next 10 years. So one thing we know is that's going to be wrong, but it is a best guess. And so we have to hang our hat on something, and that's what we hang our hat on. When we see their market projections, they present to the board, and then the board sets the asset allocation, which is the left-hand side. The board sets that through consultation with Callan and staff. The CIO, Marcus Frampton, the CIO, will give his recommendations to what we should do. The board can listen or not, and same with they can listen or not to Callan. They set the asset allocation, and what they're trying to do is with the least amount of risk, get the highest return. And so they come up with those targets, public equity is 32, fixed income at 20%, with a range around it. What that range allows us to do is it allows Marcus, the CIO, to make investment decisions based on that asset allocation. So fixed income gets really cheap. He can go to 25% fixed income, but the 5% has to come from somewhere. So those are all moving parts that allows him to try to meet the expectations, the return expectations. One thing I want to then talk about is, so we have that allocation. From there, that's our mandate. You're allowed to do these, you're allowed to have this asset mix with that range. So I'm going to turn to the next. So what we then do is try to beat that. There's certain ways, and what we're trying to do is it's called total return. We're trying to beat a benchmark. And as investors, our sole focus is on beating a benchmark. That's it. That when I walk in the morning, that's all I want to do. So I'm going to, and since I manage the fixed income portfolio, it's easiest for me to explain it through our portfolio. We have a $16.6 billion portfolio that's internally managed. 3 years ago, we brought all assets in-house. That was a decision because our outside managers weren't performing as expected, and we didn't have as much control over the portfolio as we'd like. So we brought it in-house. The good thing about that is it was $8 million in fee savings. But those fee savings don't mean anything if you underperform. If we would rather pay managers that perform and pay them a fee, but in this case it didn't work, and we decided to bring it in-house. So the nice thing about these charts is it shows that we've actually added some value. So each one of the six small squares on the right are individual portfolios that we manage in-house. And for instance, the U.S. corporate portfolio, that's my day job. So I'm responsible for that. I manage, it's a $4.5 billion portfolio. Over the last 5 years, we've beaten by 64 basis points. In real dollar terms, that's $25 million a year of excess return that we beat versus a benchmark. So if we just had it in a passive account, just did an index fund, by not having it in an index fund, we've earned $25 million a year every year for the last 5 years. So we take each of those portfolios that are weighted. So the U.S. Ag and the U.S. Corporate are the two largest. They're 27.5% each. High yield's 10%. Global rate's 15%. TIPS 10%. Fixed income cash is 5%. We take those, we bundle them up, and they all roll up to the left large square. So all of those small portfolios with their individual benchmarks that everybody who works on one of those portfolios is trying to beat that specific benchmark. I'm trying to beat, for the U.S. corporate portfolio, I'm trying to beat the Bloomberg U.S. corporate index. That's what I'm trying to do. And that is they're all rules-based indexes. So it is every U.S. corporate that's investment grade, larger than $350 million, and anywhere from, like, I think it's 18 months out to 40 years is in the index. That's my opportunity set. I have to decide which bonds I want to own that I think are going to beat that index within risk parameters, and pretty tight risk parameters. All that rolls up. The fixed income composite then is all of those together. And that fixed income composite we can try to beat either through each of these individual portfolios outperforming their benchmark, which is what they've done, and deciding which of those six squares is going to outperform the benchmark. the overall market. So if U.S. corporates become cheap, I will overweight U.S. corporates. Right now, they're extremely rich, and so we are underweight U.S. corporates versus the benchmark, and we may go in, and then I have to allocate that to other portfolios. So that is our focus, beating benchmarks. Okay. So now if we take that to the fund level, and this is where then Marcus, this shows whether or not Marcus and staff are doing a good job. The top, the performance benchmark is based on the board allocation. So what that says is, okay, the board has given us a benchmark to beat, can we, and an asset allocation. With that in mind and under risk, certain risk parameters, can we beat the benchmark? And it shows over time that we have. 3, 5, and 10 year, we've beaten the benchmark. And over 10-year period, that's added. Because we beat the benchmark given, we've added about $6 billion in actual dollars, and that is through Marcus's calls that he's made, overweighting stocks, underweighting bonds, or whatever he decides he wants to do at the time, and staff's talent in beating their benchmarks. And so that is directly related. You can say, are you doing a good job based on what the board has given you? The passive benchmark essentially says, okay, if you're just an individual investor and you just want to invest in 60, you've heard of 60-40 portfolios before. Ours is 60% equities, 20% fixed income, 10% REITs, which are real assets, and then some, and then 10% TIPS, which is inflation. How are you doing versus something that you could easily index? It'd be really, really cheap, and not very sophisticated. If you're not beating that, then you really have to think, okay, why are we here? We do beat that, and we beat that through both through asset mix, meaning that Marcus makes calls, overweight stocks, underweight bonds, and through adding additional securities that Alan will talk about in markets like all the private markets, private equity, private credit, absolute return. So we add complexity to the portfolio. Is it working? And in this case, the answer is yes, it's working, because we're beating on a 3, 5, and 10 year. The return objective that you just talked about, CPI plus 5, that is the bane of every investor's existence, because that is not investable. We can't go buy something that's CPI plus 5. If we could, we would, because then the job's done. We're doing exactly what we need to do. So that is something that is more, for us at least, not something that we can focus on or do focus on. The board focuses on it with asset allocation. Callan focuses on it. We as investors internally focus on the performance benchmark, hopefully beating passive benchmark. I think that's really all I have for my three.
Thanks, Jim. For the record, Alan Waldrop, I'm the Deputy CIO of Private Markets. And I spend most of my time covering the private equity portfolio, but also oversee our private income category, which is private credit and infrastructure, along with real estate. So we're on slide 15 now. Just wanted to spend a bit of time on some of the private markets things we've been doing. So APFC has been investing in the private markets since 2004 when we started in private equity. It's been a good outcome for us. We've generated significant value there. If you look at the slide, this shows the value we've generated relative to if those same dollars were invested in just a public markets index. So if you compare it to the Russell 3000, which is the most comparable to PE in terms of the size and breadth, we've generated roughly $9.2 billion of additional value, net of all fees paid. So the concern in private markets is liquidity, which is something that's been touched on, and fees. In terms of liquidity, our private equity portfolio in particular, it's the oldest portfolio on the private side. It's the most mature. It's been cash flow positive 15 of the last 16 quarters and 4 of the last 5 fiscal years, which is great. Not a lot of investors can say that. And I think that's in large part to how we've managed it, how we've been thoughtful, particularly Marcus and the board, about how we allocate there and how we commit dollars there. Fees are a consideration in the private markets. The fees are substantially higher than the public markets, but the trade-off is that you're getting additional return and the value capture that you see on the chart. If you're not getting that value, then the fees don't make sense. it's tough for us to eliminate the fees. We can't do that, but we do things to manage them and reduce them where possible. So in our fund agreements, we negotiate the best terms we can. One of the biggest tools we have is the ability to co-invest alongside our investment partners on a fee-free basis in transactions that we think meet our return criteria. As Jim noted before, if you're simply reducing fees, if you lose money on an investment, that will wipe out any fee savings. So we want to make sure the investments are high quality, but where we find something we like, we try and maximize the fee savings there. And I'll give you an example. In early 23, we invested $45 million in a company in the energy space alongside one of our partners. That company did very well. It was sold in early 2004. We made 2.2 times our investment, or a profit of $55 million in 1 year. It's a great outcome.
Mr. Chair, just Devin Mitchell, and if I might, I think I've heard this explanation, and I think a lot of times it's lost in translation. And so our partners, so we're a limited partner with a general partner in these investment opportunities in the private equity space. The general partner will identify a company that they want to acquire. That's what they do. They acquire these. It could be a privately held company, a publicly held company. They're going to take private, whatever it might be. They're going to acquire something. They've done all the diligence. They've had an analysis that they believe this is a good company to acquire. They say, hey, it's a little bit bigger bite than the fund wants to take on. Do you want to participate outside of your fund investment on a co-investment basis? And so we get an opportunity to deploy money where we're not subject to the same fee structure that we are within the general partnership. So there's a benefit in a reduction of fee that we receive as a result of the opportunity to co-invest.
Thank you for that explanation, Mr. Mitchell. Please proceed.
Alan Waldrop again. Thank you, Devin. I take this stuff for granted because I do it all the time, so appreciate the clarity. So anyway, we generated a profit on APFC's investment of $55 million in a year, which is great. But because of the structure, we also avoided paying $11 million in fees on that gain. And so that's just a tangible example. And to put some more context around it, fiscal year to date, so the 6 months from July to December, we've invested $250 million in those types of investments. And so we think they're very attractive investments. If they perform as planned, we think we'll save roughly $65 million there. So there's things, you see the fees we pay in the line items, but we're doing our best to try and minimize it where we can.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This slide and the last slide have been impressive. I mean, it really shows what having a great team can do. A question, I guess, about these private investments. The co-chair talked about the liquidity questions. But, Mr. Waldrop, I think you said that I can't remember if both private equity and private market or just these private markets. The fund's consistent cash flow and consistent gains are unusual in the category. Not everybody can say that, or most funds can't say that, you said. So the question I have goes to how do you calculate the risk we're taking? I see the line on the slide about, well, we have a mature portfolio. But maturity in itself doesn't take away risk. What are these our riskiest investments? Because it seems like we've been loading them up in the recent years.
Through the chair, from an asset allocation perspective, when Callan does the modeling, when they look at risk in terms of standard deviation and things like that, these are the highest risk. And so when you go through the risk spectrum, you have things like fixed income, very low risk, very stable, move into equities, higher return, higher risk. And then you move into the private category. And there's different risk levels within privates. Infrastructure is less risky than private equity. Real estate is akin to infrastructure in terms of risk. And so there are different risk levels within the private markets. And once you're in the private markets, there's things you can do to manage risk in terms of, even within private equity, there are certain strategies. If you're investing in early stage companies that are startups, that's much riskier than established businesses. If you're incorporating certain types of credit or even in certain types of industries are riskier than others because they're higher growth. It's sort of high growth, high return, more stable returns. And then you have other things like the amount of leverage you use. And then when we're looking at managers, we look at track records. You know, we try and manage risk by making sure we're investing with people that are established, very good at what they're doing, and being very selective versus, say, somebody new to the business. Maybe they don't have as extensive a history. So they are risky, particularly when you look at the menu of choices we have. But we do our best to try and manage that risk through the work with Callan in terms of the asset allocation, but also the things we do to select the investments.
And, Mr. Chair, this is Devin Mitchell again. I think part of the question relates to the two account structure that we have. And so unrealized gains within the private market portfolios are much less liquid. You can't easily diminish your position before the strategy has reached fruition. There isn't a strong secondary market for doing so, and you might be getting less value if you try to get out of one of these investments before the GP, the general partner, is ready to divest of those assets through the most effective strategies. So that's one issue. When you have a growing portfolio, you're going to have a growing unrealized gains class of gains, of earnings, that in our two-account structure isn't spendable. So that's kind of a weird off-to-the-side thing. Otherwise, I think as you build up any portfolio, you're going to be deploying money. Once it stabilizes, which is the case with our private equity portfolio at this point, that you wind up getting the exits as you're putting new money in. So if you have 10 years of experience, which is the average life, 10 to 12 years. So as you get to that point where your portfolio is that age, you'll be investing to maintain a portfolio size, but you'll be receiving the back end, the payoffs of that investment strategy. The illiquidity comes in the middle. And so once you've built it up, it's kind of like if you're a pilot and you fly in your bubble. If you take it with you, it's good. We're in our bubble now, and as long as we take it with us, we don't expect that unrealized gain balance to grow further. I think we expect it to remain more relatively static, and there will be noise in that given every market situation we're in. But on average, we've built up this balance. It just doesn't conform to the two-account structure.
Senator Gill.
Thank you. So I think I saw somewhere this is, 18% of the portfolio? So it's... You've heard the concerns, right? Least transparent, least liquid, high risk. I think the bands are plus or minus 5%. So I think what I'm hearing is that we're not interested in coming up much from 18%. Is that what you're telling us about keeping the bubble and entering and exiting at roughly the same cash amounts, and we're not looking at going near a quarter of a portfolio?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, the asset allocation and investment policy set by the board, and we're in conformance with that policy. And that I don't believe that staff is going to be making recommendations to increase the allocations to private market in asset classes. And it's not just private equity; it's the private income as well, which is an additional $9 billion-ish or so. And then real estate, of course. Real estate's I read Dave Rose's book not long ago, the first executive director of the permanent fund, and he was bragging about Tyson's Corner, which I think every executive director since has bragged about. We still hold it in our portfolio, purchased for less than $100 million. It's got hundreds of millions of dollars of unrealized gains associated with it. It's a strong performing asset, $130 million in annual revenues, but do we want to sell it to realize those gains? Again, it comes down to this two-account structure and the statutory framework that we live within.
Can I add something? Jim Parise. The marriage between public and private is also what Marcus is extremely focused on. So that's why we have a 20% allocation to fixed income. Well, fixed income is a liquidity provider. And that's, we should not be taking risks. So that's why you see it's an investment-grade portfolio with a little bit of high yield, but it's high-grade, high yield. We're seen as a liquidity provider in any kind of market turmoil or anything. As far as like the bands are there to be able to take advantage of certain situations. It's very hard to take advantage of a situation in private. Alan can talk about it more. That's such a slow-moving market that it's really hard to overweight or underweight that, so we'll stick to that. But you may see in public equities, we're at 32%. You could go to 37% if there's a massive market sell-off. You would be able to take liquidity from fixed income, put it into equities, and take advantage. And so that's what the bans are there for. It's to take advantage of certain situations that markets does not like to deviate very far from the targets, because it's, if you don't have a good idea, don't come up with one. I mean, it's best to just do nothing and stick with these bands. But if there's a good idea, which they don't come around very often, but when they do, you want to be in a position to take advantage. And I think Marcus does an excellent job at that. That's why we're always look like we look like the target. I mean, if you look at our right now deviation from the target, it's like we're at 32.2% in equities. So we're essentially a target, and it's just market movements that make get us away from the asset allocation set by the board. If that, I don't know if that muddied it or made it more clear, but that's. But he is very conscious about the liquidity for the portfolio and how we can manage that.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Please proceed.
Alan Waldrop again. This next slide on page 16 just shows a comparison between us. We thought this was relevant. There's been comparisons made between APC and others recently. I'd say. Surface level comparisons are challenging because these are different organizations that have different mandates. That could be liability management, principal preservation, liquidity streams, as we've talked about. And that drives different allocations for each organization and different approaches. So comparisons on an absolute basis are difficult versus benchmarks are difficult. And so they should only be made with a real detailed understanding of the differences. One of the groups we've been compared to is Norges Bank. Which is Norway's sovereign wealth fund that manages the oil and foreign exchange reserves for Norway. So it's a similar construct on the surface as APFC. However, it also serves as a central bank of Norway, which means it's got much broader responsibilities, including managing economic stability through monetary policy. So they're focused on a lot of other things, which is obviously much broader and significantly different than APFC. When you look at this, there's a lot of stuff on the slide, but the main difference really comes down to asset allocation between the two groups. So Norges Bank is primarily public markets with 71% equities, 27% fixed income. So it's basically a traditional 70-30 portfolio. They've got a different objective, different regulations. They've got a different size. Very challenging for them to access any illiquid markets because they're $1.7 trillion. If they go into the private markets, or real estate or anything in size, they can destabilize those markets. APFC, on the other hand, we've got a much more diversified portfolio, as you've heard. We're at 32% equities, 20% fixed income, and then we've got 12% in real estate, 27% across private equity and private income, and 10% in hedge funds and others. So different allocations intended to achieve our targeted return with managed volatility and principal protection and generate the liquidity we need. I'd say when these comparisons tend to get made when public markets go up. So because of these differences in allocations, groups that have a higher weighting to equities like Norges Bank at 70%, they will outperform more diversified portfolios when the public markets go up, as they have in the last 2 years, and they will underperform when the public markets decline. So people are focused on sort of the most recent history. Just if you go back to 2022, where there were significant declines in the public markets in the second half of the year, APFC, as Devin noted, had a slightly negative return. I think it was negative 1.2 or 1.3%. Norges Bank had a negative 14.1%. So that's a significant difference. So they tend to experience significantly more volatility, and volatility is something we try and avoid because of the payout structure. So if you have any kind of payout structure, volatility is very difficult to handle. There's other differences on here with regards to currency. They report in a foreign currency basket. Fees, they tend to report gross of fees, we're net of fees, and then the time periods are different. So just when you're comparing things, I think it's important to keep some of these things in mind.
Two notices. I've been to Norway and talked to their managers many years ago, and two of the things that people should note: that they are a country, we are a state, and the other major decision that they made is they kept their income tax and we did not. Pardon?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
I don't think they pay a dividend.
Oh, and they don't pay a dividend. So major differences. Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, one of the other differences I note is that, of course, they have the home office in Capital City, but then they don't add one in Bergen, which is about 225,000 people.
Thank you. Please proceed.
On slide 17, we just wanted to give you a quick overview of our process. We've got a weekly internal investment committee meeting that's open to all investment staff as well as the chief risk officer. The voting members are our CIO, Marcus Frampton, and then Jim Parise and I, the two deputy CIOs covering public and private markets. The meeting is typically led by the heads of each asset class, so we go around and give an update from each asset class. We cover any investment decisions, which we view as voting items, so purchases and sales, as well as performance updates, strategical and tactical ideas, any decisions that need to be made, with like positioning within the allocations by strategy, geography, industry, and then any other items of interest. So it's a real open forum, a lot of diverse viewpoints, a lot of candid discussion, and I found it to be a great forum for exchanging ideas. And then the last slide I'll hit is just our org chart. This is just a visual depiction of the investment team. Again, Marcus being the CIO, Jim and I serving as deputy CIOs. We've got 11 people on the public market side, which covers equities and fixed income, and then 13 on the private market side, which covers private equity, private income, and real estate, and then the others assisting our CIO and then covering hedge funds. And we've got a couple of vacancies we're working to fill on the private side, but we're making good progress.
Thank you. Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you. So how much time did you say we have? 20 minutes now?
No, you have 40 minutes.
40 minutes? Okay, we'll try to hustle through some of these. There's a lot of concepts that senators would have heard before. But one of the issues that we've discussed before is the difference between statutory net income and GAAP income. So when the permanent fund was created, there wasn't a definition of GAAP income that included unrealized gains. Now on our financial statements, we report the GAAP income, which includes securities that we hold that have increased in value and what that difference is, and it's recorded in the year in which the value goes up or down. And so you can see that statutory net income in that bar chart on the left is less volatile than GAAP income, but it's also less in general. And that's been that trend of growing, a growing war chest of unrealized gains that Senator Stedman was referencing in some way, that we are maximizing return, but we're not maximizing spendable return because unrealized gains aren't spendable in the statutory construct we have. So it creates, again, greater volatility from our earnings perspective, but greater earnings on average over time. And again, you can see that in the chart on the right reflected in a different fashion. And it's part of the struggle that's leading us towards discussions about the two account structure in general and the earnings reserve account and how it might be modified to diminish uncertainty in the future. This just shows statutory net income history and projection. Of course, our projections are always to the right and up. The reality is it's going to be something like our history where it's choppy. And you can see that if there were to be years, this is just laying the groundwork for the story, that if there were years like 2002, 2003, or 2007, those types of statutory net income years would be somewhat extraordinary, but there's inability to deal with that type of event in the current construct in the earnings reserve account. So it's putting you on notice that there are scenarios where there could be issues with us providing a percent of market value transferred to the state of Alaska in the current construct if we had a negative market experience. The averages that you can see, the 2015 to 2014 year average statutory net income, $4 billion. The need for the coming fiscal year is $5.5 billion. $4 billion for a POMB and $1.5 billion for inflation proofing. So we have a bit of a mismatch from that historical calculation. The fund has grown during that time frame, so there's some adjustment that would occur because of that. The shorter average, 5 years, is 4.5-ish. And so we're closer to the target, certainly able to meet the POMV transfer that's required to meet the needs of the state, but maybe not able to provide for the inflation-proofing appropriations from realized earnings of the fund if that trend were to continue.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe just for explanation, could you go over a little bit about how the, you know, when we appropriate in like this current fiscal year, or you can take, I think that would be a good example, $1 billion, when that transfer actually takes place, because I think the legislature has some flexibility on that decision clear up until the last appropriation bill leaves this table in May.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Senator Stedman, inflation proofing is appropriated at the end of a fiscal year. So for the fiscal year that we're in, 2025, the transfer of $1 billion hasn't yet occurred. It would occur in June. So there would be a flexibility for the legislature to adjust that appropriation or to have an additional appropriation through a supplemental process or a budget. The practice, the accounting practice of the permanent fund has been admittedly conservative. We commit on July 1 of this fiscal year, we committed the coming fiscal year's POMV transfer. So fiscal year 2026 POMV transfer was committed on July 1 of 2024. That's conservative. At the same time, we commit the current fiscal year's inflation-proofing appropriation of $1 billion. This year, we were $400 million short from the available balance in the earnings reserve account to provide for that conservative structure. That's the first time that's happened. And so it has reached a point where there is a shortening of the runway between the needs of the state and the resources that are available in the earnings reserve account.
Senator Stedman.
Just for a point of clarification, the reason I bring that up, particularly for the newer members or newer folks watching, we do have a safety valve in that we could change that in this particular year, that $1 million appropriation in the upcoming appropriation bill, and zero it out if we had to. I don't think we would intentionally set up a transfer to the corpus from the earnings reserve for inflation proofing, knowing that we probably wouldn't be able to attain that. So we look at that at the end of every budget cycle, and we will again this year when the committee decides to make the recommendation of how much to put in inflation proofing. That's why $1 billion was selected versus $1.4 billion or some other number higher. We knew we were a little bit light, but we did that to recognize the liquidity issue the permanent fund is facing. And we'll re-review that probably in a couple months when the chairman gets into the nitty-gritty of the operating budget. I just thought I'd put that on the table because most of the presentation today, I don't think, Mr. Chairman, the Finance Committee has any issues with any of it. We're proud of the permanent fund and proud of their returns and their hard work and their staff. You know, we just recognize that there is a statute requiring, you know, maximizing rate of return, but you want to follow the law. But the law also is 5%, right? Not much difference in the dividend structure we have here, where we have a statutory dividend calculation that's substantially different than the 5% draw. And we have to take them both into consideration when we make our policy decisions. So nobody is asking the permanent fund not to follow the law. There's just several laws on the books.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Mr. Mitchell.
Thanks. This describes where statutory net income is sourced. So again, statutory net income is realized income where we've received a rent, we've received a coupon payment on a bond, a dividend from a stock, some other disbursement from a private market investment. And those average at this point about $1.7 billion a year. So that's a base case scenario, if there wasn't any active management or churn of the portfolio realization of gains, that would be your base case. The portfolio, I think I've heard Marcus say, is churned around 20% per year. So that's across the asset classes, obviously more in public markets than private markets, but on average about that amount. And that's where the balance of the statutory net income comes from, is of unrealized gains being realized through the sale of securities or investments that the fund holds. The actual amounts of unrealized gains are in the middle of that chart on the right. And so you can see public equities, $4.6 billion, private equity, $4.4 absolute return, $1.9 real estate, $1.4 private income, $1.6 fixed income's negative right now, and then other. So we already discussed that the private markets is going to be less likely to have chunky disbursements in realized gains, because we're in this cycle of investing and then realization that's around 10 years, and that tends to be a little more predictable, although I guess I should take that back, because market conditions do dictate different things. If interest rates plummet and at the same time there's a bit of hype in the IPO space, you'll probably see a big pop in realized gains from the private market. So I probably should have characterized that a little differently. Public equities, there's a stress test that's been put on this particular chart just for public equities, and so you can see the impact of a market correction of 25%, and that positive unrealized gain turns to a negative unrealized loss. 12.5% correction, and you're down to about $1.4 billion. Conversely, if you have some positive market experiences, you'd have those correlated increase. 12.5% bumps that up to $7.9 billion, or 25 to 11.1. It just highlights the impact of market experience on that unrealized gain and correlated gains that you might expect to have in that time frame where you have that market experience. This shows the 23-24 and fiscal year to date earnings by asset class, and this is where you can see the numbers Alan referred to, 700 million-ish in the current fiscal year, 766 in 24, 863 in 23. The largest contributor has been public equity, which preferred and common stocks is how it's labeled here, but that's been the largest contributor. It's a hard word, contributor to realized earnings. So fairly informational. You can see those balances at the bottom that realized earnings number, the target that maybe would be identified for us is that it should be the POMV draw plus inflation, and we're obviously not hitting it with these years. There's still hope for fiscal year 2025, that we have about half the year left, obviously, and if there's gains realized in line or statutory net income in line with the first half of the year, we'll be at about a break-even proposition, around $5.5 billion of statutory net income. And this is getting into that different issue, the larger issue of collapsing the two accounts into one account. And I think that the world that I tend to revolve within, the concept is fairly broadly accepted. The one concern that I hear about a one account system is, well, what if you have negative market experience and there's an invasion of principal? Because you no longer have this concept of, oh, we have principal and then we have earnings, and earnings are what are spendable, which we have in our somewhat flawed but current two-account structure. That concept is baked in. And if it quickly leads me to just ask, do you really understand what principal is in the current construct? Is it $20 billion of royalty revenue? Is it $58 billion that's in the principal? Is it $70 billion when you layer in the unrealized gains? What is it that you're thinking is protected? Arguably, it's the $58 billion that is allocated to principal, not including the unrealized gains that are allocated to principal. And so if that's your number, if that's what you believe needs to be protected from this point forward as principal, it wouldn't be that hard to layer in a floor to anything that was considered as far as how you might collapse a fund into one fund. If you said, well, we shall not ever spend this fund below $58 billion, because that's principal. And you could inflation-proof that number, and that could resolve that concern. Otherwise, when you flip over to more traditional endowments and how they have their draw structured, it's almost uniformly some form of percent of market value, because that concept resonates within the investment community and from a financial management practice for a fund that's designed to live in perpetuity for the benefit of some entity. So in any event, there are some structural challenges in the two-account system that we currently have that I think we're seeing in no small part because of the POMV overlay that we've had since 2018, with fiscal year 2019 being the first payout. Prior to that, it's almost like being retired at this point, that prior to 2019, we were in build mode. We were giving out a permanent fund dividend, about half the historical 5-year, 20% of the last 21% of the last 5 years' earnings. And the other half, it was just getting saved. It wasn't getting used for anything. The statutory framework says it can, or the constitutional framework says it can go to the general fund, but it wasn't going to the general fund. It was just staying in the permanent fund. And so we were in growth mode at that point, with half our earnings going into savings basically every year. Now we have this overlay of a 5% draw, which is a little, it's a use mode, a harvest mode, and it's intended to be a draw rate that's sustainable in perpetuity, but it is a draw rate.
Back then it was referred to as the rainy day fund.
Yes.
Even though it must have started raining then, since we came up with the POMV.
I think fiscal years 15 through 18 were fairly rainy. That was a tough time, as demonstrated by this chart on the right, where you can see fiscal year 15 through 18 revenue for the state of Alaska having declined from a recent peak of over $8 billion to around $1 billion for several years. And that was a very difficult time for the state. The POMV coming online, as we've discussed, in 19 and becoming the most stable and now largest source of revenue for the state of Alaska on an unrestricted general fund basis. And that from a financial perspective has been a huge resolution to a problem that existed for a long time with a state that's reliant on extraordinarily volatile revenues, that having stable revenues is a luxury that that we didn't have prior to the POMV transfers from the permanent fund. And the calculations on the left, the last five fiscal years, completed fiscal years ending balance, the average of that, 5% of that average is the draw rate, very predictable. The draw rate for the coming fiscal year is projected at $4 billion. We already have a pretty strong estimate that that's what it's going to be, not fiscal year 26, but fiscal year 27. Fiscal year 26 is the 3.8. And this is getting into some of that conversation about what is principal, 70.5 in the principal, but really only 58.6 in principal if you carve out unrealized gains, because as soon as those gains are realized, they shift over to the earnings reserve account. The earnings reserve account, $9.1 billion, sounds like a lot of money, but then you start looking at it and you go, okay, $3.8 billion for the coming year's draw that you guys are budgeting for right now, $1 billion for this year for inflation proofing. And then unrealized gains that are squishy as those earnings, as the ERA balance diminishes, those unrealized gains flip over to the principal because they're just pro rata allocated, the unrealized gains. $2.7 billion spendable right now. That's what you have. And that's for that projected $5.5 billion need that you're going to have on July 1. This slide's just drilling in on that earnings reserve account.
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, on slide 26, there was a, if I could take a moment, Mr. Chairman, there was some discussions a couple of times over the last few years of overdrawing that 5%. So if we were to have overdrawn that 5% as recommended by a previous revenue commissioner and amongst other people, where would that be putting us in our liquidity position?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, the most important feature of any financial construct is discipline. And anytime you deviate from discipline, you're setting yourself up for failure. And so the idea of just one time we're going to take more than is prudent is it's just the first time. And so I mean, and this is just me personally. This isn't necessarily, maybe I'm speaking out of turn, but I don't have a calculation of where the fund would be, obviously, if there had been larger draws taken, but it's easy to say that it's likely that the stress we're experiencing now would have been exacerbated. But certainly I do think that that overlay of financial discipline and setting limits on ourselves for how we use our resources is important. It's going back to that fish thing. You set a net across the river, and 4 years later, guess what? You caught the last one, depending on the type of salmon you're catching. So it's the same sort of thing. You know, we're going to catch a few extra just this one time.
I might state that Senator Stedman talked about overdrawing the 5%. That was never a discussion. That was never a recommendation or a decision at this table. So for the people that are watching, I think the conservatism of this finance committee over the last decade is should be well noted.
And so this again is just the drill down on the ERA, and you can see the balances from fiscal 19 to the start of fiscal year 2025 going from 12.9 billion to negative 0.4 billion. And so that's the trend that we've been trying to just educate folks on, that's a trend that's concerning and warrants the consideration of change. And that could be the change like we've discussed at the table today, potentially different direction on how funds are deployed to try to match up to definitions of what is revenue that exist from a 1980 statute. Or it could be consideration of a one fund where you have a draw that's not reliant on a realized income but reliant on total return. Liquidity isn't our problem. It's our statutory construct. We can come up with, I mean, Jim could come up with $1 billion tomorrow if we needed $1 billion tomorrow and $5 billion tomorrow if we needed $5 billion tomorrow. It's a matter of can we spend it within the construct that we have. And this is more of the same of that discussion about the earnings reserve account. We're trying to hit it in multiple ways. You can see statutory net income again in the numbers below the bar chart, $3.3 billion to $3.2 billion in the experience, low point of $2.5 billion, high of $7.9 billion. The volatility of that revenue stream is, like I said earlier, less than gap income, but still relatively volatile. The POMV commitments and inflation proofing for each one of those years. So again, like fiscal year 2020, we had high, fiscal year 23, we had high inflation. 2020 was a makeup appropriation and paying it forward appropriation. But in 23, we had high inflation that required a much larger transfer to keep up pace with what my memory says is a 7% inflation rate. So the net impact on the earnings reserve account is reflected at the bottom, and the plurality of those experiences has been draws on the earnings reserve available balance, with 21 and 22 being the exception to that. And so a trend that's worth highlighting. This is our inflation-proofing slide that we discussed earlier. I don't know that we need to grind into this more, but again, how we portray it based on our understanding of the 2022 special $4 billion appropriation that didn't have the same inflation language that the 2020 special $4 billion appropriation had, results in a $2 billion underfunding being represented on this chart. If we're mischaracterizing it, then it's $2 billion overfunded.
For the record, Jason Bruni, Chair of the Permanent Fund. I guess just following up on what Devin just said, I heard you loudly and clearly, Senator Stedman and Senator Hoffman, about what the thoughts were of the committee at the time that money was appropriated. To make sure that we're on the same page, maybe specific language reminding us of that with the budget might be helpful, because obviously, you know, I'm not saying it's a difference of opinion, but it's hard to, if we don't get that specific direction from the legislature for what that $4 billion was for. I heard you, I know what you intended, but that's not what the language was that was there at the time. So we need to make sure that there's consistency there for how we present this going forward. Obviously, the trustee paper that was distributed last year, number 10, this was not the first time that the trustees have come forward with the concept of joining the accounts. I think for decades, similar recommendations have come from the multiple trustees that we've had. The Council of Alaskans met, I think, in 2003 with a similar recommendation. So as this paper says, and I think it shows that the current two-account structure, it introduces significant risk to the ability to fund the annual POMV. Transfer that supports the state budget, now over 50% of the state budget, and, of course, the permanent fund dividend. So the next couple slides go into the details. We, like I said, we delivered this paper to legislators last year. There are, I think, 12 new members this year, so we'll make sure that new copies of it are delivered to everyone to make sure that you see the current perspective of the Board of Trustees and what our recommendation is for that. You know, obviously, specifically on this slide, just the talk of combining the two accounts to establish a permanent endowment model in statute. It would require a constitutional amendment. I've had conversations with Senator Giesel, with Senate President Stevens, and with a number of you as well. Obviously, what Gary said to me is he wants to make sure that we have something that the governor can support, that you all can support. I know there's been a lot of different concepts. I'm happy to try to help facilitate and bridge the potential differences, having been formerly with the administration, to make sure that we get something that is palatable to the legislative branch and the executive branch. I know there's been discussions about specific details other than joining the two funds, the number of members, the qualifications of members, potentially paying members, because it is a volunteer board. We as a board are not going to take a specific positions on any of those. Those are obviously this board and are this body and the executive branch's perspective. But you know, the trustee paper number 10 does focus on the specifics of joining the two accounts. And I know there's a lot of other Christmas tree potential items that have been discussed. I'm happy to help engage with you, but it's generally those type of policy calls are not going to be we're not going to take a position on those specific things as the board, but we did take a position on the joining of the two accounts.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It can be nice when you present to the legislature that you reinforce the advantage of the percent of market value approach blocking overdraws without a vote of the people, because there's significant concern that the permanent fund gets raided. And we can work on the policy of 5% or 4.5% or 4.75% payout is minuscule in impact compared to a looting of the permanent fund. So that, to me, is one of the best protective measures we can give future Alaskans, because it's only a matter of time before there's a structure within the legislature that just the easiest course is to loot the permanent fund and walk away. And that's totally unacceptable. So I'd like to see you reinforce that. I think it'll sell well to the public, too.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. I was chairman of the Senate House Finance Committee when we drafted the language for the resolution that was before the legislature creating the Constitutional Budget Reserve Account. That was a constitutional amendment, and that requires 27 members of the House and 14 members of the Senate for approval. That's a very, very high standard, and it took a lot of time and a lot of effort to get that through the legislature back then, but the benefits of that constitutional budget reserve account are well known in this building and in the, I think, in the public. And I think more time and attention needs to be given to setting up this account. It's going to take just as much work, if not more, to get that accomplished, but I think that it needs to be done. Mr. Mitchell?
So I don't know how much specificity you want me to get into about the trustee paper or about the current two account structure versus the one. I think we've kind of beaten that dead horse to death over the years. But Mr. Chair, I'm happy to go into more detail if you'd like me.
I think we will wait for the resolution to come forward from other committees, and we can get into more detail at that point.
Mr. Chair, I think this is the punchline, that this is what we have with a lot of moving parts and potential for pitfall by a particular generation, and this is what's suggested, a streamlining and simplification without pitfall potential, meaning that you don't have to manually inflation-proof and you don't have the ability to overdraw without a vote of the people. And I think that was well said. And it is one of the primary factors in considering the change that's been laid out by the trustees over the years.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the work that went into Trustee Paper 10. I generally agree with the reasoning, and I think, you know, you've heard that there's going to need to be a lot of conversation, a lot of modeling on what that draw limit is, and I think we'll look to the permanent fund's expertise on what's sustainable to help us form our thoughts on behalf of Alaskans. So I'll look forward to working with you on that. I will just flag, Mr. Chairman, this slide may oversimplify it just a little bit. We don't maybe get rid of that appropriation for the permanent fund corporation's operating expenses. That still comes through here.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Please continue.
Yep. Mr. Chair, if you're interested, I haven't discussed it with him, but I did reference him earlier, our Chief Risk and Compliance Officer, Mr. Vadakumcheri. He's done several one-off presentations. He's done a really interesting analysis of why a fund like ours, it makes sense to have diversification rather than just a 100% equity portfolio because of volatility and the draw that we have on our fund at this point, and the fact that when you have a draw on a portfolio, it reacts differently from a return perspective relative to a fund that doesn't have a draw. Like, it's the same concept as once you retire, you change your investment strategy because you're drawing on your retirement funds. And in addition, as I already referenced, that he has done some initial work on what a what different draw rates, probability of success and failure might be, and so it could be informative. It doesn't mean that those analyses are the final word or the only way that you can look at the issue, but it certainly would help give you a framework.
Further questions from the members of the Finance Committee?
Yep, Mr. Chair, I just want to add one final thing.
Do we have closing comments by Mr. Or are you finished with your presentation?
Well, I just wanted to add to this, but sure, I do have closing comments as well. But
go ahead.
I want to be very clear that the trustee paper is the position of the trustees. It's not the position of the Dunleavy administration. Now, each of us obviously were appointed by Governor Dunleavy, but we have taken this position on our own. Similarly, we've taken the position that I mentioned earlier about the confidentiality of personnel records. The budget that we put forward obviously did go through the full process. We appreciate the partnership with the full process and vetting with the administration. Sorry, I saw the look on Senator Stedman's face. And so that has been discussed, but the others are the position of the independent Board of Trustees. And so I'm committed to obviously talking with the governor, to talking with each of you as this does or does not go forward. It's definitely an issue. The merging of the two accounts is something that we are keen and think that is important, that needs to happen for the stability of the fund, for the stability of and predictability of the 5% or whatever draw percent of market value that we're going to be having going forward. Again, on behalf of the Board of Trustees, I really appreciate the opportunity today. I'm very fortunate to the staff that we have at the Permanent Fund is exceptional. And I want to thank again the legislature for its commitment to helping us recruit and retain them, compensate them for the quality of staff. We've brought, as Jim indicated, we've brought a lot of this function in-house. We're outperforming the benchmarks and we're paying less. That is something that we want to be highlighting. I'm stoked about that. And that those are Alaskans doing this work. So kudos to Devin and his team. With that, those are my concluding remarks. Happy to answer any questions and give Devin the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Bruni. Mr. Mitchell, closing comments.
I'd just like to thank the committee for the opportunity. I think it is time well spent with examining what we do. I personally appreciate any constructive criticisms because it's an opportunity to reflect on how to improve, and that's what we all want at the end of the day. So. We're here to do the best that we can from the investment house of the state of Alaska's perspective, but look to your guidance otherwise.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. I would like to thank, on behalf of the committee, thank Mr. Mitchell and his staff for all their professionalism, and thank the board for all the work that they do. And I would like to welcome John Binkley, who he's a former senator from Bethel that preceded me, and I'm sure he's going to do an outstanding job. Any closing comments from the committee members? If not, that concludes today's meeting. Our next meeting will be tomorrow, Wednesday, February the 12th. We will have a brief introduction of Senate Bill 56 and 58. The operating and mental health budgets to the committee, followed by the Legislative Division of Finance and the OMB and Budget, the Management Office and Budget, and letters of agreement, and finish with the conclusion of AGDC's presentation that we had yesterday. Are there any additional items? With that, we stand adjourned.